From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a victory for a Washtenaw County woman after her ex is found guilty of extorting and intimidating her. Now Nicole Beverly waits for his sentencing.
My goal is for it to be enough time for my youngest son to graduate from high school. And then for myself, of course, to relocate and basically disappear so that he's not able to find me once he is released.
A geologist explains why Michigan has such big underground reserves of potash.
These salts are the result of long ago evaporation of ocean water that covered the state of Michigan.
The Muslim student who chose a small Christian college in West Michigan.
There were people there who had never met a Muslim.
And winter driving in the roaring 20s.
It was a conversion kit of an extreme proportion, so you had these giant pontoons with corkscrew tracks through them.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This hour, how can men help prevent domestic violence?
People may not be actively participating, but if they remain silent, if they don't take actions when actions might be called for, or they don't have a proactive stance against it, then that might be lending silent support, or sometimes in the field we use the term collusion. They're colluding with the problem just by their silence.
That's later this hour. But first, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality is now considering a proposal that could put Michigan in the forefront of potash mining. It turns out there's a treasure trove of potash sitting beneath our state, and extracting it to be used as in fertilizer production could pump as much as $65 billion into Michigan's economy. But there is concern, serious concern, the process could endanger the surrounding environment and groundwater. Indeed, the very same groundwater that Nestle taps for its Ice Mountain bottled water in Osceola County. Geologist Bill Harrison is here with us now. Bill is director of the Michigan Geological Repository for Research and Education at Western Michigan University. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So you are the one that studies all the underground reserves we have in Michigan. So you're the one to ask this question, just what is potash and why does Michigan have so much of it underground?
Potash is a naturally occurring mineral. It's actually a salt, very much like the rock salt that is mined and spread on our roads or the table salt that we put in our food or any other chemical that comes out of salt deposits. And these salts are the result of long ago evaporation of ocean water that covered the state of Michigan. And as that water evaporated, the water went away into the atmosphere, but the solid material, the salt in salt water, crystallized out and formed these deposits on the seafloor.
And potash is used for making fertilizer, correct?
That's correct. If you look at a bag of fertilizer, you'll see three numbers on there, which tell you something about the quality of the fertilizer. N, P, and K are those three elements, and N is nitrogen, P is phosphorus, and the K stands for potassium. It's one of three major ingredients, and plants can't really function efficiently if they don't have potassium. It facilitates them being able to uptake water.
So how do you feel Michigan's potash deposit and purity compares to the big potash players on the world stage, countries like Canada and Russia?
Potash is a relatively rare substance, and you can imagine that there's not that many places in the world where you have evaporated the oceans to concentrate large thicknesses of these salts. And the Michigan Basin, which is, it's a really a geological bowl in a sense. During much of the history of Michigan, the ocean water covered the state, and the seafloor kept subsiding and creating more space to accumulate these deposits. So over time, thousands of feet of these salts, along with lots of other kinds of minerals, accumulated under Michigan. That's happened in a few other places in Russia and in Western Canada. We see large deposits of that. And in the U.S., in Utah and New Mexico, there are some deposits. But most of the U.S., and in fact, most of the world, doesn't have that kind of setting of an environment that would cause that. So we're really fortunate here in Michigan. We have lots of natural resources that have accumulated over time, and this potash is just one of the new ones that hopefully we're going to be able to start developing.
Well, and we have a company called Michigan Potash that's asked the DEQ for this permission to begin extracting potash at the rate of 650,000 tons a year with a facility in southern Osceola County, basically 8 solution mining wells, 3 processed brine disposal wells in Everett Township, using up to 725 million gallons of groundwater every year. Tell us, how do they extract potash? Is it akin to fracking?
No, it's this layer of salt deposits is about 300 to 400 feet thick, and it's at a depth of about 7,000 feet below the surface. You can't really dig a mine that deep like the salt mines that's under Detroit. What you have to do is drill a well and then pump water down there, and the salt dissolves in water, and then they pump the brine or the salt saturated water back to the surface, and they have large evaporating tanks, and they evaporate it, and then they collect the solid material once they've removed all the water from that brine solution.
Can we talk a little more about that?
Sure.
Because I you know, when we think of pumping that water down, I think a lot of us think that is pretty similar to fracking. So can we talk more about how it compares to fracking?
Okay. Fracking is a completion technology that's used in certain kinds of oil and gas wells. And what it does is they inject water and usually some other solid material like sand or some specially engineered little spheres. And they inject it at high pressure so it breaks the rock. It actually fractures the rock. And so I like to call fracking hydraulic fracturing because it tells you what is actually happening. You're using water, the hydraulic part, and you're fracturing the rock down underground somewhere.
And then compare and contrast that with what will be done to extract the potash, because we know that there are disposal wells and water is going back in.
That's right.
So compare and contrast for us.
Okay, so there's no fracturing involved in this process. All they do is they pump water down. You know, if you take a handful of salt and throw it in water, it'll eventually dissolve. So their purpose is to go down and get this solid layer of salt, pump water into it, and it starts to dissolve. And as that salt goes into solution, it becomes a brine. They pump that brine to the surface, extract the salt, pump the water back down again, dissolve more salt. So it's an iterative process. At first, there'll be just a little tiny area from the drilling of the well. Maybe it's an 8 or a 10-inch diameter hole that they've drilled. And then the water will start to corrode on the inside of that well bore, and it'll eventually enlarge and enlarge and enlarge until it becomes a cavern underground that's maybe 50 or 100 feet across and maybe 100 feet tall. So what they're doing is they're actually creating an artificial cavern down underground, and all the solid that they remove from there becomes the potash that they're commercially after.
So when you hear concerns voiced by environmental groups with Michigan Potash wanting to extract almost 2 million of gallons of water every day, that's 725 million gallons of groundwater every year, and that's more than 5 times what Nestle's drawing for its bottled water operation just a few miles away. How much of a concern, in your view, is this large volume of water usage?
Well, first of all, that permit that the DEQ is asking to allow, that's the maximum amount of water they can use. It's my understanding that they don't always use that much. There's a recycled component as they're evaporating the water that can capture the steam and then reuse that. So that's the maximum amount that's being used. I don't think we necessarily should assume that that's actually what's going to be used every day.
But is that sustainable when you've got these two companies pumping out that much water every year? Because certainly people who are with environmental groups are very concerned about this sensitive wetland area with these plants there. Is it sustainable?
It depends on where the water's actually being withdrawn. Most people's homes or any kind of domestic production of water comes from approximately the upper 100 to 200 feet under the ground. And there are freshwater deposits in that region that go down at least 700 or 800 feet. I believe the Nestle's plant removes water from much deeper, so they're not taking it from the same zone. Back in the ice ages, a few tens of thousands of years ago, as the glaciers melted, they left a lot of sand and gravel all over the surface of Michigan. All that sand and gravel now down to up to 1,000 feet is filled with fresh water. So there's a hugely thick interval, and it's hard to comprehend, but the amount of water that's stored in these underground aquifers, they're called, or just in these sand and gravel formations, is many times the volume of the water in the Great Lakes. It's just an enormous quantity of water. So hundreds of thousands or even millions of gallons of water is less than hundreds of percent. So it's a very small total of the amount of water that's in the system.
Bill, what of migration of waste into the groundwater? What happens to that salt brine that comes from extracting the potash and that production?
First of all, they recycle a lot of that water. So there's a small amount that's left at the end of the process. You know, if they're moving 1,000 gallons, there would be a few tens of gallons left at the end of the process. The rest they would be recycling. But the rules are that they have to re-inject that into a deep formation that's well below the freshwater zone. So those disposal wells that you mentioned, those would be the places where they would inject that, and they're going to go down thousands of feet below the surface. And they'll be injecting that brine back into brine-bearing formations.
Can a balance be struck between the environment and industry when it comes to potash mining? I guess I'm asking, do you believe the environment can indeed be protected even as all this potash is being extracted?
Oh, absolutely. And Michigan has demonstrated this with lots of other extractive industries. Governor Snyder had a symposium in Lansing a few weeks ago on extractive industries. And Michigan produces enormous amounts of natural resources for the benefit of our society. And there's really been very minimal impact from the extraction of all these natural resources. The state regulates all of these wells, and they have very strict regulations that control how the well is constructed and how the well is operated. And in fact, the state of Michigan has been a model for many other states. Our state geologist has gone to other states and testified before their legislatures when they are compiling their rules for regulating wells. And Michigan is being used as a model because of our really good record and also our high quality of regulations.
So I guess bottom line, how would you address concerns of people who put in public comment when that period was open, who are opposed to seeing this kind of activity?
As an educator, I'm always encouraging people to gain as much knowledge as they can, because once you understand how various processes work, various industrial processes, or how the earth is constructed, you have a much better understanding and the ability to make decisions on risk rather than just assuming a position without really very much basic knowledge. And I think that being able to get educated about the volumes of water that are available, what the process is, what the benefits are versus the risks, I think it really helps the public if they become more knowledgeable about these whole activities.
Bill Harrison is a geologist with Western Michigan University, where he directs the Michigan Geological Repository for Research and Education. Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hope College is a small, private, liberal arts college near Holland in West Michigan, founded in 1862 in partnership with the Reformed Church in America. So its Christian identity is very central. My next guest is among its more than 3,300 students. Let's say she brings a different point of view to Hope. Sophia Hatab is a freshman at Hope studying English and computer science, and she is Muslim. She's turned her experience of being Muslim in West Michigan into an award-winning essay titled Through the Dome. Sophia Hatab is with us now via Skype. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So you are from Chicago. You are Muslim. So why did you choose this small Christian college in West Michigan?
It's actually kind of funny. Hope was like at the bottom of my list of places I wanted to attend just because I thought I wanted a large institution. No religious affiliation. Everything that Hope was like the complete opposite is what I wanted. You know, I had to keep visiting for like scholarships and other interviews and stuff. And my admissions rep, who's absolutely fantastic, he was like, you know what? You never really know if you like a place until you stay overnight and do like the overnight taste of Hope is what it's called. And I was like, well, I'm going to be here. Might as well. Right. And I did the overnight, and it was one of those moments where I'll never forget it. I was like crying in my host's dorm room because my heart was so full of God in that moment in a way I didn't really know how to describe. And it just felt like I needed to be there. And when I finally got my last letter, I was immediately like, all right, Dad, where's the credit card?
Let's do this thing, right? And now you have turned this experience of being Muslim in West Michigan at this small Christian college, you've turned it into an essay called Through the Dome, and you have won a prize for best addressing the experience of being Muslim in America. Tell us a little about this prize.
So the Haja Razia Sharif Sheikh Prize is in nonfiction and it's in poetry, and it's through the Oakland Arts Review, which is hosted through Oakland University. So I submitted for nonfiction. You don't have to be Muslim to actually submit anything, but it's all about sort of the joys and the challenges of being a Muslim in America or Islam in America.
Yes, and here you are being honored in a sense for being a voice for your Muslim sisters and brothers.
Which is crazy because it's just insane.
Well, I tell you what, would you read us a little bit from Through the Dome?
Yeah, sure. So what did you think about your overnight visit? My admissions representative beamed, his teeth catching the glare of the windowed sun. Did it give you some guidance? How was I supposed to explain just how light I felt? How I felt I could fly up through the swaying scrapers back home and hug their aluminum frames? Or float away like the picture of my dad, his exhausted form leaning over the bakery sink, washing dishes in the 90s? I think it did give me some guidance. If his mouth could smile any wider, it did. Sophia, I want to caution you. He leaned forward in his chair, striped tie shifting past his knees. You're going to be different here. I nodded.
Beautiful writing. Beautiful, beautiful writing. And Sophia, knowing that truth there, I mean, it's a big adjustment for everybody when they leave home and go to college. Knowing that you would be more different, how did you feel about that going in?
It was a terrifying experience. I grew up in Chicago, but I live in the suburbs. And so it's very diverse. Like, if I tell someone I'm Muslim, nobody even raises an eyebrow. But Holland is very not like that. And I knew this going in. There were people there who had never met a Muslim. You know, a lot of these people come from, like, really small Christian towns, and they just never encountered anybody of any other faith, let alone something as, you know, criticized so much in the media today as, like, Islam is. Mm. It was a really scary experience because I was like, what if people find out? What if people find out and, you know, like, I get hated on? It's a small campus. Like, I'm not a perfect person. And I definitely made assumptions that maybe I shouldn't have.
Like what? What kinds of assumptions?
I think some of the fears. I'd assumed that people weren't going to be as accepting as they were. I assumed that the people who didn't know anything about Islam might make the worst case assumption that you would be, you know, some sort of terrorist or some sort of ISIS supporter, which is like almost no Muslims ever. Like, most Muslims hate ISIS and any Islamic terror group with a burning passion. I think part of it is you're forced to sort of make these assumptions because you've experienced them. Like, I've experienced being called a terrorist. I've experienced being screamed out of my friends' homes, you know, in Des Plaines, where I'm from, which is pretty diverse. I've been yelled out of my friend's house. Her father found out I was a Muslim, like, screamed me out of her house. Like, These are things that genuinely happen. And my brain was like, if these can happen in a diverse town as much as this Chicago and its surrounding suburbs, what's it going to be like in a town like Holland where it's super Christian?
But you embraced that. You took the jump and you basically gambled. So here you are nearing the end of your first year at Hope. How has the experience matched up with those assumptions when you came in last fall?
Totally not what I expected, period. Most people honestly didn't even care. I would tell them that I was Muslim and they would just kind of shrug. If anything, people were super interested, which I'm totally cool about. Like, if you want to know more about my faith, like, please ask. And so people would, like, just be, like, so excited and be like, can we sit down and talk about it? I had a friend one time found out I was Muslim and was like, are you doing anything right now? And I was like, not immediately, and dragged me by the arm into her room and was like, we're talking about this now because I'm so interested. I had one reaction which really threw me off, which was, I told this person I was Muslim, and they just kind of looked at me, and they were like, oh, okay. And they sort of, like, walked away, and they were a friend of mine. Like, they'd known me before they found out I was Muslim.
Yeah.
And they were just like, I need to process this. So they kind of, like, went away, like, handled it on their own and came back totally fine, like, a few days later. So.
And I'm curious, how has your view of Christianity, Sophia, been impacted by this time you've spent at Hope?
I never really had like a super negative view on Christianity. I think any form of religion is great, honestly, as long as it gives you a moral compass. The second you start using religion to justify immoral actions, I get kind of irked. You know, same with like people who don't follow a religion. Like, as long as religion or no religion makes you a better person, I really don't care. So my view of Christianity hasn't changed. I think I've become more enlightened about things about Christianity, how people practice and how people practice differently. Like, I didn't know that most Protestants don't cross themselves. And just small things like that. Like, I've attended a couple church services. Like, I've definitely gotten a better grasp of what Christianity is and, you know, what it has to offer to people. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. It does indeed. In your essay, Through the Dome, you quote some verses from the Quran, and there's one that I want to ask you about. You quote this verse, "We will test you in fear, hunger, loss of wealth, life and fruit, but give glad tidings to the patient." What were you feeling when you wrote that, and why was this verse resonating with you?
It's a verse that's always resonated with me. I deal with chronic illness and have my entire life. Muslims look at everything in life as a test from God, as a test of faith, as a test of persistence, as a test of you versus temptation. And for me, that was always a verse that was like, when you're broken and when you're down and when you've gone through all these difficult experiences, the only way out is through. And the only way through is patience. And so I've always seen is like when I've been broken and when I've been down and when things have been hard, because hope hasn't been easy. It's been hard being away from a really strong Islamic community or a really strong community of people like me.
It's a beautiful verse. And it's interesting. You can almost counter it with a verse from James, from the Epistle of James. "Consider it joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance." It's interesting.
Yeah.
So much of the same sentiment.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because when I was writing this memoir piece, one of my favorite places on campus is called Shun Chapel. It's in the basement of Graves, which is one of the buildings on campus. And it's this really intimate, small sort of chapel as setting. And a lot of students go down there and they'll make these like pictures and stuff with like markers and stuff, and they'll hang them on the walls in the chapel. And one that's always stood out to me was, "Lord, break me." Like, "Lord, please break me," with the sentiment, obviously, that if you are broken, then you can be risen again, like better, a stronger version of yourself through God and through Christ. And it was just kind of ironic because I remember when writing this piece got difficult at one point, I found myself down there and I saw that. And I just remember seeing that and being like, yeah, this is what this is. Like, this piece is going to break me.
Well, Safiya Hatab, it has been a delight meeting you. Thank you for spending time with us and sharing your award-winning essay, Through the Dome, with us. Thank you so very, very much. And good luck as you wrap up your freshman year at Hope.
Thank you.
Safiya Hatab's essay, Through the Dome, will publish in the Oakland Arts Review, an international undergraduate literary journal that's edited and published by Oakland University students. You can learn more about it at oaklandartsreview.com. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk Michigan history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
As this long, dreary winter smacks us with yet another dump of snow, I think we can agree that this winter driving creates a lot of white-knuckle moments for Michigan motorists. And if you find yourself thinking there has got to be a better way to get around in the snow, you wouldn't be the first. In fact, nearly a century ago, some creative Michiganders set out to do exactly that and created Armstead Snow Motors. Here now to tell us more is State Archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center. So, Mark, just kind of a bit of background before the modern machine age, how would Michiganders in general and farmers in particular get around in the snow?
Well, we've been dealing with snow removal for a long time. And up to the early 19th century, our method was an indirect attack. So mostly people didn't try to move the snow out of the way like we do now. We tried to work with it. So snowshoes, sleds, there were things called snow rollers, sort of like a giant version of a lawn roller that was used to flatten out the snow so that sleighs could go over it more easily. They would even ice the roads to give those sleighs better traction. Later on, we get people being a little more inventive. There were streetcar systems that had actual dedicated streetcars that would plow, not just the tracks, but they had a side plow that could grab an extra lane. So all sorts of inventive ways, but no one hit the mark until later on.
You shared with us this video from the 1920s, the Armstead Snow Motors. And I have to tell you, we were all sitting around watching this going, this thing is the coolest thing ever. So describe what the Armstead Snow Motors are.
So this guy named F.R. Birch from Minnesota first patented the concept of a snow motor automobile around 1906. And he even reported to the New York Times that same year that he and his brother were headed to the North Pole in their new snow automobile conversion. I don't know if they ever actually made it. And then another guy, H.H. Armstead, he actually incorporated the business Armstead Snow Motors in 1921 in Detroit. Armstead was originally from New York and he was an inventor. And interestingly, in 1888, Armstead patented a corn husking machine that used two corkscrewing cylinders, one turning clockwise and the other counterclockwise, to feed the ears of corn through the husking teeth. And it's really the same concept that was later used for this snow motor machine.
Yeah, just to give everybody a visual, these are kind of like giant spinning pontoons with screw tracks. They're big, and these vehicles look like they're flying across the snow. So what'd you do? Would you take off the tires and axles and put these pontoon thingies on your car or your tractor?
Yeah, it was a conversion kit of an extreme proportion. So you have these giant pontoons with corkscrew tracks through them. And the company really promoted a wide array of use for this, from farming to lumbering, mining, road clearing or road braking, and even daily driving in the family car.
Yeah, and I want everybody to go to our website because you were kind enough to send us the link to this 1924 promotional film. I guess we could call it an early commercial. And we loved watching it. You see the speed. The handling was amazing. It could just really turn on a dime. And we really enjoyed the way it compared the performance of the Armstead snow motors, if your tractor had that, versus a horse in 4 feet of snow.
Yeah, I felt a little bad for the horse, but it did its job as far as promotion. It's a silent movie with the interspersed text panels, sort of like a Charlie Chaplin movie. And we just came across this in the archives vault when I was looking for something else and dusted off the film can and was curious. And so we queued it up and got it converted. It's an amazing film to watch and to see the sort of promotion that was going on in the early days of the automobile.
Well, I can't help but wonder whatever happened to this method of snow travel, the Armstead snow motors, because I'm just thinking if you went ahead just 20 years to the huge problems that our American soldiers were facing with snow in the European theater in World War II. I mean, think of that winter of 44 and the Battle of the Bulge, what it would have meant if jeeps or tanks had versions of the Armstead snow motors. So whatever happened to the Armstead snow motors?
Yeah, you know, during the same time in the teens and the 20s, and actually even back into the 19th century, there were inventors experimenting with sort of the tank track or snowmobile track invention. So there was competition, so that's part of it. And we did find several mentions of the use of this machine, not just in the Midwest and in Michigan and the UP, but also in the Pacific Northwest. Even tracked down a model on display in the California Agriculture Museum. But we don't know what for sure killed the company or why this concept didn't catch on. Because as you said, if you watch the film, it's compelling. You think, wow, this is a no-brainer. Why wouldn't we be using this? So through our research, we saw snow motors incorporating in 1921. And by 27, they were gone.
Huh.
Also in the movie, you notice when they use the tractor, it's a Fordson tractor.
Yeah.
And when they use the car, it's a Chevrolet. So they weren't being brand loyal here. So there's lots of, if you do some research online and some other printed sources, there's lots of postulations why this didn't endure to the 40s or 50s. Maybe the automakers didn't like that they weren't exclusive. Maybe they killed it off a la the sabotage that was done to companies like Tucker. Or maybe the business model just competed with the burgeoning heavy truck development that was going on with the major automakers. But more likely, I think snow removal machinery caught up with the market And people really didn't see the value in retrofitting their vehicles so drastically. So, I mean, it was still concept form in the 20s, and they never really refined the concept. If you look at it, it significantly changed the profile of your vehicle. You know, with a tractor, it doesn't matter so much. With an automobile, you're probably not getting it into any sort of garage enclosure with those pontoons on it.
This is true. They're big pontoons.
Yeah, you have this little problem of safety. You have exposed giant corkscrew pontoons open on all sides of your vehicle. So not the safest way to travel.
Well, I will say we all watched the video and we all said, I want to ride on that. So you can go to michiganradio.org and you can go to the Stateside page and watch this highly entertaining promotional film from 1924 on the Armstead Snow Motors. State Archivist Mark Harvey, as always, so fun to talk history with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Drive safely.
On May 3rd, we are bringing Stateside to a live audience in Grand Rapids at Celebration Cinemas North, and we want your help. What stories from Grand Rapids do you think we should share with the rest of the state? Issues you think we should talk about? Are there unsung heroes or people from Grand Rapids you think we should spotlight? Let us know. Leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Or leave your idea and learn more about the event by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The torrent of death threats apparently made an impression on the Washtenaw County jury, because on Tuesday, that jury convicted Kevin Beverly of felonies for extorting and intimidating his ex-wife, Nicole. We first sat down here with Nicole Beverly last summer and heard her story of years of terrifying abuse, stalking, and death threats from her ex, Kevin, including threats made while he was in prison serving a 5-year sentence on a 2012 conviction for stalking Nicole. Nicole Beverly is here with us now. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What was that moment like for you Tuesday in Washtenaw County Court? You heard the word guilty.
It was actually pretty surreal. We had waited from about 9:15 till about 2:15 for the jury to deliberate and make their decision. And so when they came out and actually heard those words, it was very emotional and surreal that finally, you know, after all this time and all this energy that we've been putting into this, that they found him guilty.
And I know he'll be sentenced May 15th, and witness intimidation is a 15-year felony, extortion a 20-year felony. And last year, you and I talked as Kevin was about to be paroled, and you were thinking you were going to have to move right out of Michigan, pull your sons out of school, and uproot them. What does this week's conviction mean for you?
What will really make the difference is what happens at sentencing, because that's going to give us a timeline of how much time we truly have before he's going to be released. We obviously know this is not going to be a life conviction. So whatever the sentence is going to be, it's going to be a temporary sense of relief for us. But hopefully my goal is for it to be enough time for my youngest son to graduate from high school. And then for myself, of course, to relocate and basically disappear so that he's not able to find me once he is released.
And he's not out of legal trouble, right? I want to see if we've got this all straight. So he pleaded guilty last month to a witness retaliation charge in Wayne County, and he's going to stand trial next month in Jackson County, where he faces 4 felony counts of witness retaliation as a habitual offender. And Luce County is still investigating this accusation that he tried to get another inmate to kill you and your sons. Do I have that all right? Am I missing anything?
That is correct. And initially, he had agreed to take a plea, which would incorporate all of those cases. But at the last minute, last Friday, he withdrew that plea, which is why we ended up going to trial on Monday.
You have become a very important face to everyone in Michigan in sharing this story, the face of what it means to live with domestic abuse. And you've got some extremely valuable perspectives, having lived with this for years. So let's talk for a while about what Michigan can do in doing a better job of protecting survivors like you from an abusive, threatening partner or ex. You talk about the home address confidentiality. How would this have helped you?
So the address confidentiality program for me specifically would have prevented him from being able to get my address from the utility company, which is what he did when I first left. It would also protect voter registration because it's so easy now to look up someone by their voter registration information. And I know Michigan's looking a step further at the internet and ways of cyber stalking because at this point in time, it's so easy to find someone that way. They're looking to not just cover the paper trail, but also the cyber trail of people and how to best do that, which is wonderful. But without those protections in place, it is so easy to find someone.
What would it take to get this in Michigan?
So at this point, a bill was brought forward by Senator O'Brien. And my understanding is the bill's still being investigated, for lack of a better word, and the decisions being made as to what needs to happen to that bill for it to move forward to the next level.
You also talk about the need to educate high school students on issues of domestic violence. As you interacted with police and sheriff's deputies and prosecutors and judges and prison officials across the board, how well do you think these professionals understood the dynamics of domestic violence?
I don't think they understand it well enough at all. And I think that, you know, for me, is one of the big pushes for education in high school, because not only are we teaching these students the red flags for themselves for dating, we're then also educating these students who are going to grow up to be our law enforcement, our teachers, our doctors, our judges, our police officers, so that they do have a better understanding of domestic violence. And everything else we do is putting a Band-Aid on it once it happens. But if we can prevent it from happening at all, it's our best chance of ending this epidemic.
And you also talk about the need for police officers to conduct lethality assessments right there at the scene. So how can police in Michigan do a better job of determining how much danger a woman's in?
What's happening in other states, and I believe two or three counties in Michigan right now, is they are, whenever there's a domestic violence call, they're automatically doing a lethality assessment, which basically consists of a series of questions. Some are 8, some are 10, establishing history. Have you ever been choked? Is there history of domestic violence? Have you been threatened? Is substance abuse a problem? You're looking at what are the risk factors and how much risk the victim is in at that moment, so that the police officer can maybe make a more objective decision. And then the prosecutor, when they're deciding whether or not charges are going to be filed, and then even the judge when they're determining bail. So that assessment could go with that victim through all of those phases. Another benefit of this assessment is sometimes victims answering these questions themselves is very eye-opening, because then they're realizing, wow, I didn't think about this before. I really am at risk, and I need to get out of this relationship before I'm killed.
Now, how does that happen? How would we see that happen in Michigan?
So basically, we're in talks right now with Sheriff Clayton for Washtenaw County. There's a meeting coming up to see if we can at least get it started in our county. I would love to see it statewide. Some of the other states that are utilizing it are seeing reduction in domestic violence homicides. So it would be a wonderful thing, and to see our sheriffs doing it. As you know, when I spoke before, I had some not so great experiences with some of the police officers that responded to my domestic violence calls. And I also had many instances where the police did respond, but then the prosecutors denied charges. And had those lethality assessments gone along with them, perhaps those things would have been avoided.
Nicole, what is your call to everyone who heard you talk about your story? You've talked to the Free Press. You were very open talking to us here in Stateside. What's your call to everyone who was moved by what you've been through?
My call would be basically to try and get a better understanding of how to help domestic violence victims and survivors in our state. We still have a lot of work to do. I know many, many victims who still are not getting the responses statewide when they reach out for help. There's still a lot of victim blaming. I see it on the threads about my articles. I'll read lots of victim blaming comments about, I deserved it if I stayed. So I think education, educating other people, if you hear people making these comments, stop them, educate them on domestic violence. I always say I never in a million years thought this was going to happen to me. If you had told me as a senior in high school, I never would have believed you. And I think everyone feels that way. But you need to try to have a better understanding of how it happens, the cycle, the manipulation that occurs for someone to become a victim, and then to have some empathy and sympathy and help them rather than judging, because that's another reason that victims stay in these relationships, because of the shame and guilt that they carry with them be based on how society judges them.
Nicole Beverly, thank you for being with us again.
Thank you so much.
There's an important part of the national conversation about violence against women that has not gotten the attention it deserves. Nicole Beverly just touched on it. It's the role of men and boys in preventing domestic violence. Richard Tolman's a professor of social work at the University of Michigan. He believes working with men and boys could help stop domestic violence. Richard, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So you write in the conversation that there is actually not a lot of research out there supporting the idea that working with men and boys could help diminish domestic violence, which kind of surprises me because you kind of think, well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, men, we know, perpetrate most of the violence against women. So it makes sense that we would want to draw our attention to doing something with men that could either stop the violence that's already begun or prevent it from happening in the first place. But the efforts to end domestic violence are still relatively new, and the efforts to involve men in those efforts is newer. Back in the 80s, when I started working in this field, the main attention given to working with men was for programs for men who were arrested or otherwise identified as being domestic violence perpetrators. And so spent a number of decades now trying to develop those programs and look at their effectiveness. The jury's, sadly enough, still a little bit out on that, about conclusive evidence about how effective it is to work with men once the violence has begun. Having done that work a lot, I believe in that work, and I think that it's important work to be done. But it's clearly not the whole solution, because if you are just starting intervention once a lifetime pattern of abuse has begun, much more difficult to change it, and of course then still ensures that future abusers are going to be created and continue that pattern.
So let's fix what happens to that boy before he grows up to become an abusive
man. Exactly. We need, yeah. And I think there's been an acceptance for a really long time in the movement to end domestic violence and sexual assault, that we're not just talking about change at the individual level. We really have to have societal and cultural change. And so we have to think about the whole ecological picture, where we can think about beginning to make those changes and where we'll have the most effectiveness.
And you've been looking and studying the effectiveness of various programs involving boys and men, and work, you say, isn't as well known as it should be. So I want to start with sports, the kinds of things that are happening there, because it certainly seems like an obvious tie-in. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the approaches that are working that involve coaches and sports?
Yeah, well, there's a number. I mean, and first of all, if you want to talk to men, if you want to reach men, mm-hmm. sports is a place to go. Yeah, absolutely. I in my career, I've only been on a guest on a sports talk show one time. I always got asked to do interviews around Super Bowl because there was some data purported to show that domestic violence actually increases during the Super Bowl. That's questionable, okay. But still in all, it's an audience, and that's what a great place to be able to get to talk to men. That's where men are tuning in and listening, and so sports as a forum is important. So there have been these large-scale campaigns. Many sports teams have lent their efforts to various campaigns, even just around the world. In Canada, participation with hockey teams with the White Ribbon Campaign. The White Ribbon Campaign is one of the prominent global campaigns to involve men to seek gender equality and to end violence against women. So they have hockey teams here. We've had these NFL campaigns, Major League Baseball getting involved in various
other places. And they have work to do, because we've seen even on closed circuit TV video of athletes, prominent football players punching out
their
lady.
Yeah, exactly. And again, whether among the people who participate in sports, violence is more prevalent.
Yeah.
Maybe that's that might be disputed, but it's really not so important because when prominent people commit domestic violence or sexual assault, then it sends a message to society, and our response to that sends a message. And so,
what about getting in early with coaches and youngsters? Let's say when they're little boys.
Yeah, I think that's another key. So, boys and happily now girls. I was soccer coach for my two daughters, so I recognize sports participation for girls being really important as well. But that's a chance for teams, which are one of the sites of where masculinity and what it means to be a boy or a man gets played out pretty deeply in our culture. And so I think that's a really good starting point. But coaches have the ear of their teams, the respect of their teams. So getting them involved as allies to speak out against violence against women is important. And so there are some programs that have begun. One really prominent one is called Coaching Boys into Men. It was the project of an organization called Futures Without Violence. It's been pretty rigorously evaluated and shown to have impact for settings that adopt this approach. They have coaches get involved. They talk to their teams. They raise these issues. They make it part of the main focus of the sports teams about what it means to be sportsmanlike and to be a good person and to be a good member of a team. These issues play out. And so they have a curriculum for coaches. They get coaches involved together with other coaches and try to foster that kind of a support among a network of men then who are coaching these boys and provide them with information and support and attitudes at a very impressionable age that will hopefully carry on.
And are we seeing situations in school classrooms that kind of augment that or that also take that approach?
Yeah. Well, both at middle school, high school, and at university levels, there's really an effort to promote the idea that everybody can be part of the solution for changing attitudes and behavior around domestic violence and sexual assault. So some of these programs go by the name of bystander programs. They have active names like Bringing in the Bystander. The idea is to reach people who themselves might not be someone who's going to perpetrate domestic violence or sexual assault, but someone who wants to be part of the solution. And I just want to say that even though men perpetrate most of the violence against women, there's lots of men who do not perpetrate violence, and they want to be part of the solution. They don't want to lend their support or collusion. Sometimes, and the emphasis of a lot of these programs is that people may not be actively participating, but if they remain silent, if they don't take actions when actions might be called for, or they don't have a proactive stance against it, then that might be lending silent support, or sometimes in the field we use the term collusion. They're colluding with the problem just by their silence. So the idea of these bystander programs is to try to elicit the support of, in the case our target, men and boys, to become part of the active involvement to prevent violence. And so in our research, we use the term violence preventative behaviors. So these programs teach people to recognize situations where their intervention might be useful. They try to help change attitudes towards the problem so that there's less support for it, and encourage both what we call proactive strategies. That might be like an older man talking to a younger man in their network, their son or their nephew or a neighbor or a friend or a coach, a sports team, getting them to talk to younger people about why respect for women is important and why violence is unacceptable. And then there's the reactive strategies. That's maybe the classic situation, very important one on college campuses, where maybe someone has drunk a lot and doesn't seem to be able to really consent to sexual activity, and then somebody tries to take advantage of that. The idea of just getting in the middle of that and trying to prevent that in some way, either by distraction, speaking to the person who's going to do that, offering support to the young woman who is inebriated and try to help her find her way out of that. And
safely.
So that's one of the forms of bystander intervention that is taught about. Identify those situations, identify the actions somebody can take. It's complicated to know when to intervene, when it's safe to intervene, how to safely intervene, but tries to get people in that mindset.
We'll certainly get a lot of good ideas and also links to some of these programs that are out there by going to theconversation.com and looking for Richard Tolman's piece, How Working with Men and Boys Could Stop Domestic Violence. Richard Tolman, professor of social work at the University of Michigan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scott. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.